You are listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. If you are listening to the podcast of this, it is located at RudolfSteiner.podbean.com. Please consider becoming a patron. As well, there are two publishing houses, SteinerBooks.org and RudolfSteinerPress.com in London. SteinerBooks.org is in America. That are the two places that translate Steiner into English for us and give me permission to do the books. Please consider patronizing them directly. This is a reading of a cycle of lectures by Rudolf Steiner entitled Reimagining Academic Studies. It is lecture 6 of 7 lectures and a report, Collected Works Volume 81, translated by Judith Wormuth Atkinson. And this is lecture 6 again, entitled Anthroposophy and Theology, given in Berlin on March 10th, 1922. Most honored participants, I am compelled to refer to a note in a journal that was handed to me just now, a note in Die christliche Welt, the Christian world. I did not expect to be referring to this in my introductory words today, since I did not know of it. The note in the journal reads as follows, quote, "Between the 5th and the 12th of March, there is an anthroposophic college course. Friday, the 10th, is the Day of the Theologians. The lecture on Friday is an obvious challenge to theologians by Steiner and his followers," close quote, and so forth. Well, most honored participants, the lecture today may be anything but a challenge. If that is the general belief, it is a profound misunderstanding. This lecture is certainly not a challenge to theologians. I did not initiate these lectures, and I have never been involved in them in any other way except that I was asked whether I wanted to participate in this college course by giving lectures and making some introductory remarks. I am least involved with today's lecture in the sense that it was not my decision to include this particular topic in the college course. And it never crossed my mind that what we will be discussing here today could be interpreted as, quote, an obvious challenge to contemporary theologians, close quote. Therefore, dear participants, in order to avoid any further misunderstandings, repeated or new, of the few introductory words that I will say today, I will limit myself to the topic, the relationship between anthroposophy and theology, so that there are no further misunderstandings. I will give up some of the points I was going to make, because I do not wish to see my intentions misinterpreted again. Distinguished participants, I apologize if because of this challenge which was aimed at me, I am forced to include some brief personal remarks in my introduction today. I have never desired, and it was never my intention, to challenge theology in any way. Since the very beginning of our work on anthroposophy, insofar as this is about the field I am involved with, we have never tried to argue with modern theology as such. Nevertheless, this argument has happened, even though I have tried to prevent it. It has happened simply because anthroposophy has been frequently attacked by the theologians, and because some people, not so much I myself, but others, have tried to defend it. I would like to say that as a field of study, anthroposophy is intended to remain completely neutral toward theology. Its purpose is to work in the spirit of contemporary science. Toward the end of the last century, science took a particular direction. It used particular scientific methods, which led to particular scientific views. For the same reasons I already mentioned, as well as because of lack of time, I cannot go into detail about these views and these methods. Growing out of the entire historical development of modern times, they have been applied most particularly to the study of natural science, where they led to the greatest possible triumphs in human progress and welfare. I do not mean this in a trivial, but in a very profound sense. At that time, I would say philosophy was somewhat at a loss with respect to the study of natural science. Philosophy was confronted with methods which were applied primarily in natural science and which were virtually inapplicable in philosophy, a field dealing with completely different subject matter. In terms of theory and in terms of theory of knowledge, we were not sure in what sense we were supposed to use scientific methods in the area of philosophy. As a consequence, experimental psychology was trapped in an area where things were more or less apparent or more or less right, but where uncertainty remained present. By contrast, on the basis of different developments, anthroposophy established its own methods. On one hand, it takes account of things achieved precisely through the newest way of thinking and the newest scientific research methods. On the other hand, it takes account of the human desire for a spiritual world and its understanding. We were confronted with the fact that we must fully accept scientific methods. Regarding our attitude toward the area of science, I am still as much a follower of Haeckel as I was in the 1890s, as I already have mentioned. I do not mean that scientific methods should not develop further, or that what Haeckel wrote should not be criticized precisely from the point of view of science, but this is a completely different issue. With regard to my attitude toward the purely natural world, I am as much a follower of Haeckel today as I was back then. The question is what we actually experience through the scientific methods of observation and through the fact that we are trained in scientific precision and attitudes. In other words, what ideas and concepts can we form when we simply need to work with natural science? There is one thing that remains true for all methods of observation. Because of insufficient time, I cannot prove this here, but if the statement that, quote, nothing is in the mind that is not first in the senses, close quote, is true for external observation through the senses, then Leibniz's addition to that statement, quote, nothing except the mind itself, close quote, is also true. There is something much more than experiencing only the sensory in experiencing the mind. In other words, in the movements of the soul throughout the categories of the mind, in experiencing ideas that help us study an object and the facts in nature and that allow us to formulate natural laws, in experiencing the world of ideas. Thus when scientists are facing natural science and they are really unbiased, they must admit that the senses must be the source of everything that is in the mind, but the senses cannot be the source of the mind itself. Once we have fully comprehended this, nothing will prevent us from observing what we see internally and from further developing the categories of the mind through an inner psychic and spiritual process, through a process that represents internally something similar to the external processes of growth in a plant or an animal. We will be truthful to the natural process of becoming if we try looking at the human mind itself as if it were an embryo that could grow internally. From this effort, we can learn the truth that the sensory world is not the source of the mind. If we really try this, then the rest will be an immediate consequence of the growing intellect that develops into imagination, inspiration, and intuition. A process I was describing here during these few days and also in other places. This is simply a matter of the further progress in the inner development of the human being. This attitude amounts to a real view of the world. Anthroposophy is trying as much as possible to put this view into words. I admit that sometimes we are certainly forced to use unsatisfactory words for what we observe, simply because in the past few centuries our language, like all modern languages, has adapted to the external, materialistic understanding of the world. And we have adjusted our feelings related to the words more or less to that same understanding. This is why we always struggle with words when we try to express in language things we observe through imagination, inspiration, or intuition. This is especially the case when we try to express these observations in words in order to prove them using our healthy human common sense, which is another goal of anthroposophic study. In that sense, anthroposophy has always been a field of study, and this is exactly the way in which I understand it. To those who had a desire to hear what we could learn about the suprasensory world through such methods, and in the beginning there was a very small circle of such people, we will show what we can discover in this way. People are not forced to join this movement by any means. They join only by their own free will. The rumors that some hypnotic means were used are slander, in some cases a conscious and in other cases an unconscious slandering of the real intentions of the anthroposophic movement. It seems that those who, because of their healthy common sense, contemplate things, study through imagination, inspiration, and intuition, are freer than most people in our times. For example, people of our times run after the movements of their political parties and allow others to influence them in all possible ways. Anthroposophy must free the human being from precisely these inner psychological dependencies. Those who enter into the spirit of anthroposophy are not simply liberated from the most common passive way of thinking. They also make their thinking internally flexible and more powerful. Thus they become free individuals through this internally empowered thinking. For reasons that I do not wish to discuss today, originally very few scientists joined anthroposophy, even though the movement counted precisely on them. Today we are beginning to have more scientists in our circles. To those more or less naive souls with strong psychological needs, who joined the anthroposophic movement in the beginning, we have always talked about the discoveries made in a conscientious way within the framework of anthroposophic studies. I have been glad to hear some of the things that people tell me, such as one of the highly respected persons present here today. It is amazing that you get such a large number of listeners, since you avoid speaking in what people call a popular or commonly comprehensible way. In fact, you speak in a way that always requires that people do some inner work while they are listening, and this is something people usually do not want to do. Thus, I must wonder how you get such a large number of listeners. Close quote on that. These approximately were the words I heard long ago from a person who is present here today, and who, back then, visited a series of my lectures. While I always wanted to promote anthroposophy in the world, I have never looked for popularity. It is remarkable that people from all walks of life and from all denominations came to us. While through its work, anthroposophy did establish some kind of relationship to the contemporary religious movements, originally, there was never a conflict with the religious needs of the people who joined us, people from all walks of life, as I mentioned. Catholics, who are in our circles, have often asked me if it is possible to participate in the anthroposophic movement, but to remain Catholic with regard to religious practice. I said to them, of course it is possible to participate as a good Catholic in the things that anthroposophy offers. Because anthroposophy is not supposed to limit itself to one single confession, but simply to speak on the basis of the study of the suprasensory world. It would suit me best to tell people what we have found in the suprasensory world and not to participate in any polemic. Those who tell honestly what they have seen know well how it comes to polemics and how unproductive it actually is. My original desire was simply to tell what could be discovered through anthroposophy and to pay no attention to polemics. These things, however, do not always work out as we wish. Nevertheless, within the anthroposophic movement, there were people from all religions, including Catholics, and I said that Catholics can participate in the anthroposophic movement like anyone else. They might be in conflict with their religious practice regarding only one issue, the confession. Not because this is about confession. Confession itself could be considered simply a matter of conscience. I have seen many Protestant clergymen who long for some kind of a confession in order to establish a more intimate relationship to their congregations. There could be different opinions about that. The issue is that the Catholic Church denies communion to those who have not first made a confession. Because of this prohibition against participating in the most important sacrament of the Catholic Church, it is very difficult for Catholics to combine the beliefs they have established through their experiences in the suprasensory world with a behavior that does not allow them to feel free, but that the constitution of the Roman Catholic Church forces them to follow. The way confession is treated tears Catholics apart from the free observation of the suprasensory world, not because of anthroposophy, but because of the constitution of the Roman Catholic Church. Catholics could avoid this if they could avoid the confession. However, they cannot avoid the confession, because if they did, they would not be able to partake in the communion. This is the difficulty Catholics are confronted with. Despite that, there are many Catholics who are trying to satisfy their spiritual needs in the anthroposophic movement. It was only natural that people from all denominations joined the anthroposophic movement. It was only natural that our very time brought the need to discuss questions of Christianity in the anthroposophic association. I would like to say the following in that regard. As far as the subject of Christology includes questions concerning the sensory and the suprasensory in this world, anthroposophy treats the essence of Christology in the same way as any other subject. It tries to explore and to give answers about the essence of Christology through the methods of its suprasensory studies. It is difficult to summarize in a few words the character of the relationship of anthroposophy to Christology. However, I would like to note the following. We see human beings primarily here in their earthly life, between birth and death, and we realize that their existence, including their psychic and spiritual life, has the form of a physical body. We also realize that they are bound to this physical body when it comes to their views, to processing the phenomena in their environment, to their work or the exercise of their will, and generally to the way they function in the physical sensory world. Thinking back on what we see in our surroundings when we wake up in the morning, we realize that we first perceive these surroundings through the senses of the body and through the mind, which combines the experiences of the senses with our perceptions of everything that surrounds us in the physical world. Provided that sometimes we are able to look away from the environment and reflect sufficiently on ourselves, we cannot deny the fact that the mind or the intellect, which bears in itself the primordial, the intrinsically spiritual, is able to put things together on its own. This process of putting things together culminates in an idea that has now a spiritual content, a content that represents the divine or the Father idea, if I may phrase it this way. At this point, we could involve anthroposophic methods of study. I can describe this only very briefly. Anthroposophy gradually makes the entire process of obtaining human knowledge transparent. This is something that is evident from the content of these lectures, too. Its purpose is to point to the processes that occur within the human being when we try to look away from the external world in order to see what we ourselves have done, and to ask ourselves, what have we actually done? What gives us the right, the capacity, to put together the external world into ideas? As we analyze the complexities of this process sufficiently, we come to the Divine Father experience, if I may use this phrase again. Those who understand the process of arriving at the Father experience in anthroposophic terms make a very particular judgment. Please do not misinterpret this judgment, which is a fact I must express in a radical way. We make the judgment that only a completely healthy individual, someone whose physical body is completely healthy, can have this Father experience. This means that those who cannot have that experience must be carrying the traces of some degenerative problems, even if in a hidden way. In other words, anthroposophic study brings us to the conclusion that if we are not able to come to the Father experience, we must have some illness. This sounds radical, because the illness in question certainly cannot be discovered using the usual physical means. The illness is in the finest elements of the human organization, if I may put it this way. However, for those who can use anthroposophic methods of study, it is clear, atheism is disease. What I said yesterday about forming a judgment that may be right or wrong, healthy or sick, applies here particularly well. If we pursue only this path, we will come first only to the Divine Father experience. If, however, we continue on that path, and having come only to the Father experience, we realize the deficiencies of our soul, or if we become aware of the fact that basically by limiting ourselves to intellectualism, we as modern people, in a way limit ourselves to this Divine Father experience, then we will understand that we have to go beyond it. External observations could support us in this. It is remarkable that religion should be preserved in the Western world, precisely where scientific views have reached the maximum of their intensity, and where these views are not allowed to influence the area of the suprasensory. Precisely in the religious movements in the West, the spirit represented by the Old Testament intervenes and is particularly successful in our modern times. We can also see that even though the West accepts and preaches Christianity, it does so completely in the spirit of the Old Testament. We see that it molds Christ into the image of the Father, and that it is not fully aware of the difference between the two. In the East, where the human soul does not make such a clear distinction between religion and science, where this bridge is treated more or less as a very basic internal experience of the soul, as we can see in the discourses of Vladimir Soloviev, there we see the Christ experience as an independent experience, even though it is immediately next to that of the Father. Thus we can see that those who are completely healthy cannot be atheists if they put together all the impressions of the external world and summarize them in the crowning experience of the idea of God, to which they must add spiritual content. So at first they stay with the idea of the Father. With this idea, however, we cannot go beyond summarizing the external phenomena of nature. The idea fails immediately if we want to use it only to comprehend our own human development. Then we feel abandoned in a way. But if we analyze our own human development on a deeper level, from the level we reach when we internalize the outer world in our souls, and if we analyze the internal development without prejudice, then we will come to the Christ experience. At first this appears to be only an undefined inner experience. This experience clearly follows the principles of anthroposophy. We can understand the mystery of the historical event of Golgotha on our own, simply through honest observation of the development of humanity on earth. Through the internal forming of spiritual organs, the human being is led to imagination, inspiration, and intuition. If we analyze human development from antiquity to the event of Golgotha, we will realize that there were traces of preparation for the coming of the Christ Spirit living in earlier religious ideas, not only in those of the Old Testament, but in all religious ideas. Then, simply through contemplation, we can learn to recognize the fact that at the time of the event of Golgotha, the Christ Spirit was not united with the earth. If we look at everything that people searched for in the mysteries, at the time of the well-known pre-Christian religions, we will see how the ideas those people had of God eventually melded together into the Christ idea. We see how the human soul is elevated to the supra-terrestrial when people turn to their gods. We also see that in the beginning of human development, simply through the organization of the human being, people were given a great deal more than what their senses and their minds were able to perceive from the environment in their earthly existence. In antiquity, but less and less so as time went by, the human soul possessed the ability for what I would like to call instinctive seeing, a dreamlike seeing, the ability to contemplate the spiritual, non-terrestrial world to which the human felt attached. The human being experiences inner resurrection in the moment when, through the mysteries or through popular religions, the soul is elevated to things it can see as supra-terrestrial and with which, in its deepest essence, it feels united. If we analyze human development up to the mystery of Golgotha, we will realize that these inner abilities of the human were gradually diminished and no longer existed by the time the mystery of Golgotha happened on earth. Since development is not realized in sudden drastic changes, some traces of these abilities certainly remained. Some people retained, if not a precise seeing, perhaps at least an instinctive consciousness of what once was seen. We can find traces of this ability even in art. Then the mystery of Golgotha happened on earth. Anthroposophy sees in it how the spirit, which before could have been searched for only in the supraterrestrial, now flows into a human body. How Christ flows into the human body of Jesus. How exactly this occurred is a discussion we can have in detail only with those who are willing to study this subject scientifically. Anthroposophy shows that from the moment of the mystery of Golgotha on, a new era began, an era that all old religions mention Christ. Christ who went through the mystery of Golgotha, Christ whom Paul saw on the road to Damascus, this Christ remained on earth among human beings. This is the meaning of the words, quote, "I am always with you until the end of time," close quote. He lives among us. He can be found again. With some preparation, Paul's experience could be repeated again and again. However, if we take this road to Christ, who has been present on earth since the event of Golgotha, we will experience him through contemplation, by looking at our own inner development. We will find Christ through an inner experience, as we find the Father God through experiencing the outer world, unless we are sick with atheism. I can mention only briefly, in an outline, how through real study, anthroposophy arrives at the Christ phenomenon as an objective fact. Anthroposophy tries to present the Christ phenomenon in all its details as the most important fact in the earthly life of the human being, as something that has objectively occurred. Thus the entire spirit in which the Christ phenomenon is presented in anthroposophy supports its understanding as fact. Consequently, within the anthroposophic movement, we have seen Jews who, in the most genuine, truthful, and honest sense, have accepted the mystery of Golgotha. Perhaps this way, my most honored participants, the anthroposophic movement anticipates something that should occur in the future development of humanity. That by pointing out what we can see in the mystery of Golgotha, we actually rediscover the path to Christianity. We have to ask ourselves whether the point Friedrich Nietzsche's friend Overbeck makes in his book, that modern theology is no longer Christian, may not have a very deep meaning after all. Should this question be justified even only to a degree, we would have the right to say that anthroposophy is capable of bringing people to the Christ experience in a very living way. At the time when the Christ phenomenon occurred, Many people had retained their ability to see instinctively. Thus they could see the foundation, or shall I say the spiritual substance, of the mystery of Golgotha, a substance that was recognized later, in the first centuries of Christianity. After that, however, this phenomenon gradually diminishes. We see it diminishing. We see it was completely extinguished by the time of someone like Scotus Origena. We see that more and more medieval theology took root and tried to oppose the intended development of modern humanity's intellect, which, if left to itself and without inner development, could never reach the supra-sensory worlds. In a way, theology separated the human soul from its natural development impulse and divided it between the world of the things humans can gain knowledge of through intellect and the world of the unknown, which cannot be reached except through revelation. We could understand the entirety of medieval theology on the basis of this background, especially the Thomistic theology that Catholicism considers the only authoritative one. Today this could be discussed. The goal of anthroposophy was and still is nothing else but to express in a simple way what the various possibilities for a spiritual worldview are. And in the same way in which anthroposophy comes to the statement that atheism is actually a hidden disease, it also comes to a second statement. Not to find Christ, not to find any connection to Christ, is fatal. It is a fatal misfortune because he can be found in an inner experience. He presents himself as the being who has gone through the mystery of Golgotha. One can come to the Christ experience on one's own. No one needs anthroposophic study to become a religious person in the sense of Christianity. However, if you come to Christ, you become part of the spiritual world. In that case, we can speak of a rebirth of the human being into the spiritual world, of an extension of the essence of the soul through the experience of the spiritual world. We could also say that one who cannot find Christ is relatively limited in his view of the world. Atheism is a disease. Not to be able to come to Christ is a fatal misfortune. Not to come to the Spirit is a limitation of the soul. For all those reasons, anthroposophy deals only with religion, not with theology. And with religion, we deal only with respect to the fact that people who have religious needs and cannot find satisfaction in the contemporary denominations turn to anthroposophy. Anthroposophy wants to deal only with what is needed in our times and what others do not deal with. As I have repeated many times, you can deduce what our fundamental attitude is from the following. Many years ago, I gave a discourse on wisdom in the Bible in a southern German city. Back then it was a German city, today it is not. Two Catholic priests were present in the audience. After I gave my talk, they came to me and said, quote, "We didn't find anything in your discourse that could be contradicted from a Catholic point of view," close quote. I said, quote, "If I could only be so lucky all the time," close quote. They replied, "Yes," quote, "but there was one thing we noticed. It is not what you say, but the way you present it, how you put it." And here we should say that we speak to people who are in a way prepared. You speak to a community who have a particular kind of education, and we speak to all people, close quote. I told them, quote, "Reverend Fathers, this is not about making decisions according to our subjective feelings, but about moving along with the time in our work. It is important not to imagine that we talk to all people, but to answer the question, what is the objective living development of humanity? I could be wrong imagining that I speak to all people, and so could you. It is very good to imagine this in order to have some enthusiasm. But my question is, does everyone who needs to hear something about Christ today come to you in the church?" Close quote. The two could not say yes, since they knew well that plenty of people who search for a path to Christ do not go to church. Then I said, quote, "You see, I speak to those who do not come to you in the church, but search for a path to Christ nevertheless. This means to set myself a task according to current developments, and not to imagine that I speak to all people. It also means to ask myself if there are people whose spiritual development makes them more open to particular ideas. Close quote. This is the only approach Anthroposophy has ever had toward religious denominations. Even when we came to the point to be able to establish Anthroposophy as the basis of our teaching practice in the Waldorf School, we still refrained from turning this school into a place where children's heads will be stuffed with Anthroposophy. With regard to the study of religion, we have a Catholic priest who teaches the Catholic children and a Lutheran pastor who teaches Lutherans. We have also organized some sort of a class in free religion, only for those children who come from dissident families. But that class is taught entirely in the spirit of Christianity as well. Nevertheless, in this class we do not present some kind of abstract anthroposophy, nor a concrete anthroposophy as it is presented to adults. We put a lot of effort into presenting children with what is appropriate for their stage of development. Of course, first we have to search for the appropriate content and methods, and to find them. Through the introduction of a class on free religion, we have brought back to Christianity those children who otherwise would not have had any religious education whatsoever. And they come to this kind of class on Christian religion in large numbers. We never used any kind of religious propaganda within the Anthroposophic movement, and Anthroposophy was not in the least established to oppose the different theological systems. The only thing incumbent on Anthroposophy is to make the various theological systems understandable in their distinctions, and not to fight them. This is how I have always seen my task when I have spoken to people who have come to Anthroposophy, making clear why Catholicism has become Catholicism, Protestantism, Protestantism, Judaism, Judaism, and Buddhism, Buddhism, and how in all of them there is a certain kind of person who, through life, is able to experience in the soul the real Christ, an idea that I believe to be Christian. Consequently, if there had never been attacks that came from the other side, no argument between Anthroposophy and theology would ever have been necessary. Even today I am saying all this only because it was the wish of those who organized this day of lectures on theology. The only task remaining for Anthroposophy is the proclamation of the results of Anthroposophic study of the suprasensory world. This is why I have always been reluctant to react to attacks, especially when they came from the theologians. Anthroposophy does not want to act as a fighter. It wants only to satisfy rightful human needs for spirituality, as dictated by the times. Everyone who would like to cooperate with Anthroposophy in this sense, to work toward the satisfaction of these rightful spiritual needs that surface from the depths of the human soul, everyone who wants to cooperate with it in this sense is welcome to Anthroposophy. The end of Lecture 6.